Beautiful. Thank you, Dennis, for sharing with us. Before we get into things this morning, just a brief note. We're going to do things a little different, so I need at the end of the service for you all and for our Emma team to know. I meant to get to them and tell them this a little bit earlier, but we want to do something a little different at the end of the service. We're going to simply, instead of standing for the benediction, we're going to have the benediction seated, and then we're going to allow our postlude to be a meditative time together where we can have a couple of final moments of the service and prayer. So if you kind of think along with me on this, it's the benediction, we may not even pronounce the amen. We may allow the postlude to simply continue and allow that prayer to flow for all of us to have some more moments of silent prayer together. And then as the postlude ends, our Emma folks will come and follow our process for escorting folks out. Our hope is that that can be a time of additional reflection in this chaotic world that we live in, a couple of moments of additional respite and reprieve where we can reflect upon the Lord together. And I will look forward to that for some moments of prayer, and I'm sure you will as well. So I wanted to change that. For you folks who are online, you don't have to wait for anybody to get up. I mean, you're doing kind of what you're doing, and we can't see, but we're just so glad that you're here and you're able to worship with us. Now, do y'all mind if I ask you a personal question? Most all of you are saying yes, I can tell. Y'all don't mind, do you? Okay, we're going to start from this side and start answering. No, I'm just kidding. The question is, have you failed recently? Has anybody failed at anything recently? Anybody had a failure moment? I'm thinking about it may be a big failure moment, or it may be one of those failure moments to just look at yourself and just kind of say, did I really do that? Did that really just happen? Or maybe your wife says that to you. Did you really do that? Or your husband or your children or whatever else. Maybe your boss says it to you, which is, you know, that's a good one too. I remember a few months back, I was in Gaines Farmers Market with my wife, and I saw a country ham hanging up. You know those, if you've been in there, you know the ones in the big bags that are hanging up? I'm like, ooh, that looks good. And I had it in my mind that I could grill this thing, that I could just smoke it like I would any other kind of ham. I'm like, man, this would be great. Now, I was undeterred by the fact that there's not a single recipe out there for a smoked country ham. Completely undeterred by that. It didn't matter that a couple of the recipes said, warning, don't do this with a country ham. I was like, well, you know, it'll be fine. I know what I'm doing. I've smoked a lot of things on the grill now. I know what I'm doing. Smoked that thing for about 8 hours, got it just right, pulled it off the grill, and folks, it was doggone awful. It was horrible. I mean, how do you ruin a country ham? Apparently, you don't do this on the grill. You don't smoke it in that fashion for reasons that this city boy doesn't get. But whatever, it did not work at all. And I chalked that up as one of my epic grill failures because if you're going to ever do something smoking meat on the grill, you're going to have some of those moments. It was horrible. We ordered pizza that night. It was terrible. Have you failed recently? Do you have any failures in your life that even though they may have been a few years back, you still think about them and you still think about the impact that they have on you, or maybe the failure of someone else that has impacted you? Failure is one of the least loved words in the English language. It's a word that scares us, even though all of us fail at something. In fact, if we're honest, we all fail regularly, don't we? But we're terrified of people finding out that we failed. We're terrified of failing in front of a crowd where we can't hide. We know what happens in our culture. The crowds in our culture, they tend to deride and desert failures. And when we fail, we often label ourselves not as a person who failed at something, but we often take another step and we label ourselves as a failure. Today's text is a story about failure. Specifically, it's a story about the disciples' failure. And my hope is that as we look at their failure, we might more fairly address our own failures. And I'm also hoping that we'll learn to address the failures of others with deeper understanding and a lot more grace. Let's read this text together, if you would. We're in Luke 9, continuing our way through the book of Luke, starting with verse 37. says, the next day when they came down from the mountain, a large crowd met Jesus. So this is right after what we learned last week, right after the transfiguration. They have that late night experience on the mountain. They get a little bit of sleep. They come down, and right there, there's this crowd. A man in the crowd calls out, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son, for he is my only child." A spirit seizes him, and he suddenly screams. It throws him into convulsions so that he foams at the mouth. It scarcely ever leaves him, and it's destroying him. Here it is. "I begged your disciples to drive it out, but they could not." "O unbelieving and perverse generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I stay with you and put up with you? Bring your son over here." Even while the boy was coming, the demon threw him to the ground in a convulsion, but Jesus rebuked the evil spirit, healed the boy, and gave him back to his father. And they were all amazed at the greatness of God. While everyone was marveling at all that Jesus did, Jesus said to his disciples, "Listen carefully to what I'm about to tell you. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men." But they did not understand what this meant. It was hidden from them, so they did not grasp it. They were afraid to ask him about it. If you're reading closely, you'll actually notice that there are two failures of the disciples in this text. Not just their inability to drive out the spirit, the evil spirit, out of this young boy, but their failure to understand what Jesus is saying to them right at the end. You may recall that Jesus gave his disciples a great responsibility. He called them to proclaim the good news and to heal and cast out evil spirits, just like he had been doing. As a matter of fact, we see that right at the beginning of Luke chapter 9, and we also see that the disciples are successful in this endeavor, that what Jesus calls them to do. Luke 9:6. You look back at Luke 9:6, and it tells us they were successful. It says, "So the disciples went out and went from village to village, preaching the gospel and healing people everywhere." They had done this because Jesus had empowered them to do so. However, in the case of this boy with the seizures and all these other horrifying symptoms, the disciples could not bring healing. They could not cast out the demon that was driving this young boy mad. They failed in doing what only days before they had done with great success. What happened here? Now, before we go on to the disciples, let's think a bit about what happened to this boy. Understand, medical science then is not what medical science is now. They did not have a lot of fancy words and names and scientific terms to describe what was happening to this young boy. There were so many things that were just simply put into the category of demon possession that might be things that we would consider levels of mental illness, epilepsy, or then something beyond that even we still don't understand in this day of supernatural things. So we don't know everything that's happening with this boy. What we see are some horrifying symptoms, and we see that these symptoms are beyond any power but the power of Jesus himself. So in that sense, they are demonic symptoms, symptoms that are beyond our power. So when we read this, the temptation is to just say, well, according to medical science, we could figure this out. When we realize that even the healing that we find via medicine and via our doctors is rooted in the knowledge that God gives to us, is rooted in the discovery of appropriate medicinal practice. What was it like to be this father watching his child suffer? There's no greater agony as a parent than to watch your child sick and in pain and be completely helpless to do anything about it. Fathers especially, you know, we tend to think we can fix everything. And when we can't, we deal with our own failure, our own sense that there are things that are bigger than us. There are things that only God can do. Now, back to the disciples. How do you think it feels to fail in front of so many people? What does it do to your own confidence when something you did only days before now seems impossible? What does it feel like to look into the eyes of the people you worked so hard to help, only to let them down? What was it like for them to feel the rebuke of the boy's grieving father, to hear him say, "Your disciples could not help"? Did the disciples do something wrong? Well, in Luke's version of the story, we don't really know. In other versions of the story, in other Gospels, Jesus tells the disciples later on that this kind of demon can only be driven out through prayer. Were the disciples not prayerful enough? Had they forgotten the importance of prayer in their work? Had they forgotten that it wasn't them who was doing this activity, this healing, but it was actually the Spirit of God working through them, and without the Spirit of God, they were nothing? Perhaps that makes sense. We know that in our own lives, right? How easy is it for us to go through some portions of our journey fueled by the Spirit of God and then somehow to get off course and to think that we can make our own things happen for us, that we make our own security happen, that we make our own best choices based on our own wisdom rather than the inside of God. How easy it is to get off track and focus on ourselves rather than to focus on God fueling us and directing us. So that's completely plausible here. But we don't know what happened with the disciples, and we don't know exactly what led to their failure. What we do know is that these disciples, they are being trained by Jesus. Remember, we're in a mini-series here called How to Train Your Disciples. These disciples are being trained, so they are unfinished products. They are ones who are not yet all that they should be. They are the ones that Jesus is forming into leaders of the Jesus movement, but they're still at the beginning. This is evident when Jesus tells them at the end of the story, he tells them again what's going to happen to them. He's told them that he is going to be crucified, that he's going to be executed, that he's going to die. And they didn't get it before, and they don't get it in this episode either. They're still early trainers in the Jesus mission. They are simply not ready yet to understand the deeper ways of Jesus' mission. And though they've had some success in doing what Jesus has called them to do, they also experience failure, which, friends, we know this is the way the world works. When you and I train in doing something new, we don't automatically get it right. We might have a good first attempt, but there are things that we have to continue to learn. There are ways that we have to continue to grow. And if we're training at doing something that is truly a new skill, a new task, a new endeavor, we are going to have missteps along the way. You're going to experience failure even as you improve. These disciples are young learners in the way of Jesus. Failure is not a surprise, it's a guarantee. This is a hard lesson for us. We all experience failures. It's a guarantee in life. I'm not talking about the little failures like forgetting to pick a gallon of milk up on the way home or smoking the wrong kind of ham on your grill. We all fail, and if we're honest, we can all think of times that we failed huge. This past week, maybe you failed to control your temper with an employee. Maybe you failed to really listen to your children when you were together. Maybe you failed to offer grace to a person who made a mistake. Maybe you failed at making a critical business decision. We all fail sometimes, and we all fail huge sometimes, but it's not because we're failures. It's because we are not yet perfected creations of Jesus. God is still working and shaping you. He is still calling us forward to love Him with full devotion and to love others with our whole hearts. In our vocations, we have not yet learned everything we need to know to do it perfectly. So even if we have lots of experience, we are still learning. All of us are. And as long as you push forward in learning and growing, as long as you try and to grow, as long as you try to continue to make new ways, as long as you are training, you will face moments of failure. What if failure is not a stigma to avoid, but an opportunity to accelerate your growth? Now, obviously, we do not court failure, but when it comes, what if we see failure as an opportunity to learn, rather than as a defining blemish on our character? Failure hurts. Failure, however, is the sign of a person willing to continue training, risking, and growing. Because, friends, there are people for whom failure has become so painful that failure avoidance has become their life plan. Failure avoidance has become their life plan. They do everything they can do to protect themselves from the pain and the disgrace of failure. And this may protect you from some failures, but it will not protect you from them all. Furthermore, the strategy leaves you with a much deeper problem. If you do not risk failing, you will never achieve a greater goal. All great goals require risk and often include multiple failures along the way. How many of you have a favorite movie? Anybody have a favorite movie? Yeah, good. Good. Somebody's got a favorite movie. That's good. My favorite movie all time is Chariots of Fire. Chariots of Fire. I love it. The older I get, the more I can understand it, the more I can watch it over and over. Harold Abrams is one of the main characters in the movie, and he's an incredible British sprinter. He's never lost until one day he's running the 100-meter race at a meet against a rival from Scotland, and that rival beats him. The first time he's ever lost in a 100-meter race. And he sits in the stands afterwards by himself, moaning and hurting and sulking. And his girlfriend comes up and sits down next to him and says, "What are you so upset about? You were marvelous. You ran marvelous." And then she says, "Today he was just more marvelous. That's all." Very comforting. And he says, dejectedly and distraught, he says, "If I can't win, I won't run." And she looks at him with gritted teeth and a tight retort and says, "If you don't run, you can't win." A fear of failure can paralyze you and hurt you more than the experience of failure. We must not be so afraid to fail that we refuse to try, to train, to learn, and to live. Max Lucado, the great Christian writer, years ago taught us that while culture defines us by our failures, Jesus defines us by his grace. Lucado wrote that with Jesus, our failures are not fatal. When we fail, Jesus offers us forgiveness and a fresh start, an opportunity to keep learning and keep going and following him. Think about the disciples. All they're feeling is they failed to heal and cast this evil spirit out of this young boy. Maybe they expected Jesus to chastise them in front of the crowd. Maybe they were afraid they'd lose their place in the Jesus movement. Maybe they feared they would be cast back to their former life because Jesus was so disappointed with them. What a horrifying thought. Disappointing Jesus and having him toss you aside for someone better. But Jesus does not admonish them in front of the crowd. He does not cast them aside. Instead, he shares special truths only with them. And yes, the disciples did not understand these truths. But even in taking them again into his confidence, Jesus is telling them implicitly, "Guys, I know you still got a long way to go. I know you've got a lot to learn, but I'm not giving up on you. I love you and I see what you're going to become. So don't give up. You're nowhere near done yet. Sometimes we give up on ourselves long before God does. I don't know what failure is weighing you down. I don't know what's happened through your mistakes. I don't know if your failures are the result of your own mistake and sins or the result of the mistakes and sins of someone else. But I do know this. God doesn't throw anyone away just because they fail. Thank goodness. God takes failures and uses them to renew our strength, to teach us new wisdom, and to build us up so we can stand in the arena of life again. God transforms failure to victory through his unconditional love in Jesus Christ. This is the heart of the Christian story. Failure resurrected. Just look at the cross. If you're wrestling with deep failure in your own life, friends, don't give up. Jesus has not given up on you. Your failure does not have to be fatal. Even if it's a life-altering failure, the end of a vocational dream, the rupture of a marriage, the rejection of your promised promotion, facing the consequences of a major financial or relational mistake, these do not end God's purposes and dreams for you. Even when failure wounds you to the core of your soul, do not give up on yourself, because God does not give up on you. He offers you a chance, an opportunity to find forgiveness through repentance, an opportunity to start again. But what about the failures of others? After all, we are often far more critical of the failures of others than we are of our own, especially if those failures directly harm us. What do we do with the failures of other persons? What do we do when the failure of someone else ruins us? Do we become bitter and resentful? Or do we seek another way? I'm afraid, friends, that particularly in our culture, Jesus' followers have grown more adept at pointing fingers, more adept at ridiculing the failures of people they don't like, than we are at extending grace. Followers of Jesus, friends, we should be the most merciful people in the world, the most grace-filled people in the world. And sadly, we seem much better at blaming others for their failures than we are at embracing others with God's grace. Let's be honest. When people fail us, it hurts. It leaves a gaping wound. A boss who fails to live up to his promise, an adult child who fails to grow up in spite of our best efforts, a parent who only knows how to share dismissiveness rather than love, a spouse who promised faithfulness but gave in to desire, all of these failures and so many more, they wound us at a deep level. How do we respond to this? Our temptation is to write people off, to refuse forgiveness, to move on without giving up our resentment and bitterness. It seems like, friends, we give up on other people way before God does. Because God offers us forgiveness and mercy in our own sin and failures, We are called to offer forgiveness and mercy to those who fail us. In fact, Jesus tells us that extending forgiveness is essential to receiving forgiveness. Go back to the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 6. Look at the verses 14, 15, right after Jesus talks about the Lord's Prayer. And right after he shares that model prayer with us, what he says is those who extend forgiveness will be forgiven of those their trespasses. Those who do not extend forgiveness will not be forgiven. When people fail us, when their sin hurts us, following Jesus means we extend grace just like grace is extended to us in Jesus Christ. In the same situation to get hurt over and over and over again by the same narcissistic or ugly behavior. It does not mean that we refuse to hold people accountable. What it means is we give up our so-called right to get even. Our right to punish. And we live out of extending forgiveness and grace. Of course, these persons who failed and hurt us with their failure, they don't deserve our forgiveness. They don't deserve our mercy. But none of us deserve the mercy of Jesus either. And yet it was fully extended to us on the cross. We are called to be the most merciful, grace-giving people on the planet, precisely because we have experienced the greatest mercy and grace that can ever be given. And as followers of Jesus, as ones who are called to embody the character and nature of Jesus, we are called to inject into our world this same forgiveness and grace that Jesus has extended to us. And friends, when we do this, it changes the culture and the world where we live. The fact that our culture is so filled with vitriol, the fact that our culture is so filled with anger and bitterness and rage and hate and resentment, at root is not the fault of our politicians. Can I just be blunt? They don't know any better. It's the fault of followers of Jesus who have taken on the way of the world that says when someone hurts us, we hurt them back. When someone is ugly to us, we are ugly back. When we are called by Jesus to live a different way. That when someone hurts us, when someone fails and it hurts us, rather than taking on our right of getting even, rather than living and acting out of bitterness and resentment, we act out of mercy and grace, not ever to excuse, and certainly we have to hold people to account, but we can do that out of love and mercy and a passion for peace, rather than out of a passion of getting even. Because, friends, here's the thing. God knew what he was doing. Jesus knew what he was doing when he told us to forgive. Because when we forgive, when we unload the bitterness and the weight of hatred that is inside of us, we free ourselves from the poison and paralysis of hatred, of resentment. Because if you allow resentment to fester in the bottom of your soul for one person, it is not long before that resentment begins to grow. And before long, you'll notice that you're bitter about a lot of other things and a lot of other people. And before long, you'll find out you're disappointed in more and more people. And before long, what you'll discover is that resentment and bitterness has even infected how you treat the people that you love the most. It will poison you and it will destroy you from your ability to love. Friends, your failure does not have to destroy you because your failures are not fatal. But I can promise you this, if you hold on to resentment, it will kill you. Your failure does not have to destroy you, but your bitterness will. That's why Jesus offers us the example and invites us into the way of forgiveness, the way of mercy, the way of grace. One final word. When you forgive persons who have failed you, you recognize that they, like you, are not finished products. Your forgiveness may be the gift that helps them reach their full potential. Because none of us are finished yet. God is still at work in all of us. Whether we're 8 or 88 or 108, God is still shaping our character. Tom Watson, Jr., who was the CEO of IBM from 1956 to 1971, was one of the defining pioneers of the information industry. A story is told about him that there was a young executive that was working for them who had some really good ideas, and he believed in his idea so much that he went ahead and he tried his idea without running it by everyone else on the team. Turns out there was information he did not have and there were things that did not know, and his decision ended up costing IBM several million dollars. He was called into Tom Watson's office, and he went in trembling and he said, "I suppose that after this mistake, you want to fire me." Watson looked at him and replied, "Fire you? I just spent a couple million dollars training you." When we define people by their future possibilities rather than by their present failures, we give them life. Just like Jesus looked at us, and instead of defining us by our sin, he offered us life. In a culture where the world has grown less loving, less just, more antagonistic, where hate seems to grow more readily than love, we can be the people who embrace the failures of others with understanding, mercy, and grace. We can be people of forgiveness. We can respond to failure with mercy, just as Jesus has responded to our failures with mercy. As we go this morning, I'd like to pray over us the prayer of St. Francis, which reminds us that the way of this world, the way of bitterness and resentment and deriding people for their failure, is not the way of Christ, and that there is a better way that we can live. So I invite you to pray this prayer with me and continue praying as we meditate through the postlude together.